fracking has brought economic development to Ohio, but it's also brought concerns over health issues.
If we're going to do this, why are we not attempting to keep track so that we might be able to help people if they have a problem?
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the move to establish a health registry for people who live near oil and gas infrastructure in Ohio. And when a judge halted a pipeline construction project, workers faced tough choices.
Do I go chase this work out of state, or do I wait another 3 weeks? And 3 weeks could turn into 6 months.
Plus, citizen scientists are helping researchers monitor firefly populations.
How many did you see?
I saw
eight.
15.
12.
It's going to be lit. Join us for these and other environmental stories on this week's Allegheny Front. Environmental groups say they will sue a coal-fired power plant in Cheswick near Pittsburgh if it doesn't meet water temperature requirements for releases into the Allegheny River. The groups say it's releasing water that's too hot into the river. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
The Cheswick Generating Station uses steam from its coal-fired boilers to create electricity. Under the terms of a clean water permit, the plant is allowed to release that water into the Allegheny River, but it's not allowed to raise the river's water temperature more than 2 degrees. A test done by the plant found it had raised the river's temperature up to 18 degrees in one instance. Patrick Grenter of the Sierra Club, one of the groups threatening to sue, says higher water temperatures can be bad for fish because it lowers oxygen levels.
The Cheswick plant is just dumping superheated water into the Allegheny River every single time they operate.
Genon, the plant's owner, didn't respond to requests for comment. The plant has 60 days to respond. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
While the growth of fracking has brought new energy sources and new economic development in some communities, it's also bringing new health concerns for people who live near gas infrastructure. In the Utica Shale region, some Ohio residents have taken it upon themselves to start a fracking health registry. As part of our series, Who's Listening?, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
A dozen people are scurrying around a church basement in Youngstown, Ohio. They're arranging tables and chairs, setting up paperwork, and hanging up signs that read Ohio Health Registry.
Well, the Ohio Health Registry is really an attempt to collect the contacts of people who live close enough to any aspect of shale development that they might be affected.
This is Dr. Deborah Cowden, who started this effort. She's a family physician near Dayton and drove 3.5 hours east this morning to organize the registration. Cowden's group created a series of forms that take about 15 minutes to fill out.
This is the medical questionnaire, and I'm going to read some instructions first.
They ask people about their proximity to gas development and about current health symptoms, everything from levels of fatigue, nausea, and asthma, to cancer, mental health, as well as family health history. 60-year-old Martin Sengenik, a truck driver, filled out the registration forms. He's heard about a new frack waste injection well being permitted near his home.
I live less than a mile from what they're building there, and I'm worried about it.
Sengenik doesn't think the state is ensuring his drinking water well will be protected from contamination, but he doesn't know how the health registry will help.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. It might not do anything. I don't know.
More and more studies have been making connections between living near gas development and the risk of some health problems like headaches and anxiety, low birth weight babies, and even cancer. Cowden wants the health registry to provide data that will help further this kind of research as fracking continues to grow in the state.
If we're going to do this, why are we not attempting to keep track so that we might be able to help people if they have a problem?
Ohio regulators say they do respond to health concerns. Rebecca Fugit is Assistant Chief of the Bureau of Environmental Health and Radiation Protection at the Ohio Department of Health. Fugit says they just don't get many complaints from citizens about the fracking industry.
No, we only get maybe it's less than 5 a year. I mean, to be honest, it really is. We don't get very many.
The Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which regulates the oil and gas industry, also gets a few health complaints from people living near these operations. The Allegheny Front analyzed thousands of complaints by citizens to ODNR between 2009 and 2018 and found just 10 reporting headaches, rashes, and breathing problems. But ODNR did get more than 400 complaints about odors. Certain odors can indicate pollutants in the air. Fugit says the health department does respond to citizens who think pollution from oil and gas development or anything else is harming their health.
And we work with them on a case-by-case basis to investigate their complaint, to collect environmental data as needed to, you know, respond to their concerns and determine if they have been exposed to any contaminants.
Fugit says Ohio tracks various health statistics, just not specifically in relation to fracking activity. And Pennsylvania and Colorado do have registries for people living near the oil and gas industry to report their health concerns. But some health advocates say they're not doing enough.
I'll tell it like it is. I think it's shameful.
That's Raina Ripple. She runs the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. She wants the government to proactively collect community-wide health data on people in shale gas communities so it can better regulate the industry and protect public health. Her organization started a national health registry for fracking in 2017. An analysis of the first 100 to register found that people living within a quarter mile of gas development were more likely to report coughs, headaches, and anxiety compared with those a mile or more away. But she says this kind of data should be collected in a more systematic way.
I mean, we have to do our best, I'd say, to really fill in the gap. I think that this is really us, these small groups, these groups that don't have a lot of resources, doing the work that we know needs to be done, and hopefully the states and or the federal agencies will ultimately pick up the ball that they've dropped.
Marcellus Drilling News, an industry publication, criticized Ripple's project, writing that it encourages people to blame every headache and cough on gas development.
The medical questionnaire begins by asking about your past health.
Meanwhile, the Ohio group so far has 65 people on its registry, and with more registrations like this one in Youngstown, is hoping to reach 200 by the end of the year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
That story is part of the Allegheny Front series, Who's Listening?, about fracking in Ohio. It's supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism and the Sear Swetland Family Foundation. For all of the stories in the series, go to AlleghenyFront.org/who's listening. Fireflies can make a summer night seem magical. But are you seeing fewer fireflies than you did when you were a kid?
It feels that way, but I think I don't go out and look for them like I did when I was a kid either.
Julie Cicchini is a self-proclaimed lover of bugs who has fond memories of catching fireflies as a child in her grandparents' backyard. Like many insects, fireflies or lightning bugs are declining.
There seem to be fewer, but I'm wondering if it's because of all the light in the world we have now and things that folks use on their yards and that.
Cicchini's questions led her to sign up for a recent firefly watch training at Beechwood Farms Nature Reserve run by the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania. Firefly Watch is a citizen science project to help researchers figure out what's affecting firefly populations. Andy Cubis went along to learn more.
The Photinus family glows greenish-yellow, and the Pyractomina glows amber.
You don't have to go to a class to become a volunteer for Firefly Watch, but if you do, you'll learn a lot. For starters, they aren't bugs or flies. They are bioluminescent beetles that light up because of a chemical reaction in their abdomen. Each variety sends out its own distinct signal.
This one does two flashes in a row. Flash, flash. Then he waits 4 seconds, flash, flash. This one does a flash, 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 flash. And then he stops, and he flash, flash, flashes again. So they can tell one from the other by the pattern of the flash and the length of the flash.
This is Scott Detweiler, a nature educator at Beechwood Farms. He's leading a small group of kids and adults through a firefly watch training. There are three common varieties in Pennsylvania. The one you see the most often is the Photinus pyralis, also known as the Big Dipper, because it makes a J-shaped swoop as it lights up. Fireflies use their bioluminescent signals to find and attract mates, kind of like a silent love song. The male flashes, and the female, hanging out in a tall blade of grass, sends a signal back saying, "Yeah, you seem good. Come introduce yourself." Fireflies also produce a chemical that makes them unappetizing to other creatures. In fact, fireflies are predators.
See, do we see any that are sitting on foliage? These guys are all moving. That's the adults. But see, there's one down here. See one sitting? And she's just doing a flash.
After a quick lesson on firefly behavior and mating rituals, Detweiler leads the group outside to practice the very simple protocol. All you need is a stopwatch and a couple of minutes once a week to do some counting.
You just kind of pick your spot, and just within your field of vision, how many do you see? All right, and that's all there is to it. So let's set one up. Let's do a 10-second count, and we'll see what numbers we come up with. Beginning now.
We all stare into the same patch of darkness to observe. We're not counting specific fireflies, just how many flashes we see in the 10 seconds.
Okay, stop. How many did you see?
Eight.
15. 12. Yeah, it was nothing for the first 3 seconds, and then they all went crazy after that.
At home, volunteers repeat 3 times within a few minutes and then record the numbers on a form, along with a few data points like weather conditions, habitat type, and if any artificial light is around. Whenever it's convenient, participants upload their data to a website maintained by Mass Audubon. It gets passed on to firefly researchers who are trying to learn more about the geographic distribution of fireflies and which environmental factors impact their numbers. Maya Haber came to the training with her husband, Sean Guillory, and her 8-year-old daughter, Zoya. Haber is from Israel, and she says for her, just seeing fireflies feels like a novelty.
I didn't even know that they existed until I came to the U.S. Like, I'd never seen them before.
Okay, I didn't know they existed until I left California.
I just saw an amber one.
Dude, there's a flying one.
Some fireflies begin flashing at dusk and blink for less than an hour. Others start later and keep at it until midnight or so. But they'll all continue lighting up the night sky through the end of the summer. Detweiler from Beechwood Farms says if you like fireflies, you can do some things to encourage them to come to your yard. Plant grasses and shrubs of varying heights, don't use pesticides, and turn off the porch light. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Cubis.
Have you ever caught a firefly in your hands or in a glass jar? We spoke with Sarah Lauer, an assistant professor of biology at Bucknell, who studies fireflies, and she has some tips if you want to get a closer look.
Fireflies are very susceptible to getting dried out. We keep them in jars without any holes, and we often even add like a moist piece of paper towel or a moist coffee filter or even a piece of apple just to keep the humidity up.
Lauer says adult fireflies only live for a couple of weeks, so the best thing is to catch and release. Appreciate them and then let them go. And turn off your porch light so they can find a mate. Lauer says fireflies are a great starter insect for kids and adults.
People don't really like to be out at night, and they don't like creepy crawly things. And fireflies get you to experience both of those at once.
She says they're cute and cool and a great springboard to introduce the idea of conservation and the wonder of nature.
All this really interesting biology makes you realize how much maybe we don't know about the world. We think we know, but we really don't. And so there's so much more to discover.
Caught one!
Oh, this is the dead one.
Ew, then why is it still glowing?
For more tips on observing fireflies, go to AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to the Allegheny Front.
I catched about 5.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and for some 19th century painters, fog and smoke were beautiful.
It's surprising that such a famous work, looking at it today, is so modeled. And that's the way it looked because the pollution was so very, very bad.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, a modern look at air pollution and art. Stay tuned. Two multi-billion-dollar natural gas pipeline projects are under construction in West Virginia. If completed, they'll transfer billions of cubic feet of natural gas out of the Appalachian Basin to the East Coast. Conservation groups sued several of the pipeline construction companies. In December, a federal court sided with one of the groups, and construction of the 600-mile Atlantic Coast Pipeline, or ACP, stopped. Brittany Patterson spent some time visiting with host communities who feel like they've been left in the lurch by the shutdown. But as she explains, the benefits of the pipelines depend on who you ask.
When Melissa Wilfong first heard that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline was going in the ground just a few miles from the community where she has lived her entire life, she wasn't happy.
At first, my first thought was, oh no, you know, they're going to just tear up everything and be a nuisance.
Hundreds of workers would soon flock to Valley Head, a community of a few hundred people in the shadow of the Allegheny Mountains in Randolph County. But then Wilfong's father suggested the local community center, which the family helps run, should host a welcome dinner. Soon, every Tuesday, hundreds of pipeliners, many from out of state living in campers nearby, began showing up for a home-cooked meal. Warming dishes are stacked on the counter next to a range and double oven. Wilfong says at times that wasn't even enough space to prepare dinner and dessert.
It gets pretty crowded in here when there's more than two or three people, but we made it work.
Plates were $10, but the pipeline workers often left more. Each dinner brought in $600 to $700, money Wilfong says helped the center, which is largely grant-funded. But it wasn't just about the money. The workers were the first to take up a collection when a community member's home burned down. They bought presents, Christmas dinner, and groceries for two families during the holidays.
You know, we made friends. These people would have done anything for us here, and they're gone.
Construction stopped in December after a federal court ruled that the U.S. Forest Service made a mistake when it gave the Atlantic Coast Pipeline a permit to cross under the Appalachian Trail. Within a few weeks, most of the workers left, and the dinners in Valley Head stopped too. Valley Head is not alone. Along the ACP's 600-mile route, there are dozens of communities like it that were taken by surprise when construction suddenly ground to a halt. Pipeline developer Dominion Energy, which has a majority stake in the project, says it will pay millions of dollars in taxes and create 2,000 construction jobs in West Virginia. And that doesn't take into consideration money spent at local businesses in the five counties through which the pipeline is being constructed in the Mountain State. County budgets are taking a hit. So too are some businesses working with the pipelines.
So we've had some trucks that obviously we idled. We're, you know, busy trying to reemploy them.
Greg Hedges is president of J.F. Allen, a construction company that supplies gravel and builds roads and staging lots the pipeline uses. They invested more than $1 million in four new trucks last year. They haven't laid anyone off, but delayed plans to hire new workers.
We were running 6-12s. We've backed off to more of a 4 or 5 day schedule now.
It takes anywhere from 1 to 3 years to build a large natural gas pipeline like the ACP. It's not a permanent job, but it can be a good one. And some see this build-out of natural gas infrastructure, including pipelines, as the future for the region. On a recent spring day, about 40 union apprentices are sitting in a classroom at the West Virginia Laborers' 170-acre training center in Mineral Wells, West Virginia. Multiple trainings are held here, including a month-long pipeline safety training class and a rigging training. Inside a classroom, the walls are covered in butcher paper with colorful drawings illustrating things like traffic control and how to safely hoist heavy pipeline into the air. During one lesson, students weigh the merits of using different materials to attach pipe to a crane.
The alloy steel chain I don't have here, that's the metal mesh.
Corey Dornan is the training supervisor at the center.
It's real unfair to these folks who have trained and prepared themselves for the job for something to shut down that they're relying on with no expectation of, hey, when can I get back to it?
He says union laborers working on pipeline projects like the ACP have at least 160 hours of training before they ever step foot on a job.
When they shut these jobs down, they don't know if they're shutting this job down for a month, 2 months, 6 months, or a year, or indefinitely. So these folks, not only is their livelihood in jeopardy for a little while as far as this job, but they're almost in limbo of, do I go chase this work out of state, or do I wait another 3 weeks? And 3 weeks could turn into 6 months.
Dornan worked for 4 months on a 42-inch natural gas pipeline in eastern Ohio. He says the high wages on these jobs make them extremely desirable.
It was almost like hitting the lottery when you got that phone call to go work on that job because the money was really good.
He's seen colleagues pay off a car or put a chunk toward the house when they get a pipeline job.
Jobs like these really give people a chance.
But they come at what cost to the environment? Those are the questions environmental groups opposed to the ACP and other pipeline projects are asking. And they're getting some answers using the legal system.
These are extremely risky projects.
Greg Bupert is a lawyer with the Southern Environmental Law Center, one of the groups that has filed lawsuits against the ACP. He says in addition to the risk to the climate posed by fossil fuel infrastructure.
In Appalachia, an impact that I think is often overlooked is it is very difficult to build these projects on steep mountain slopes. There's a risk of explosion.
The Sierra Club is also involved in fighting the pipeline's construction. Kelly Martin directs the Sierra Club's Beyond Dirty Fuels program. She says she understands the frustration directed at environmental groups that have sued pipeline projects like the ACP. But she says the Sierra Club and others got involved because concerned citizens living along pipeline routes asked. And she rejects pipeline developers' arguments that these projects benefit residents.
They're not at all long-term economic benefits for the communities, and yet there is long-term pollution associated with the construction of the pipelines and with the fracking for the gas that feeds them.
She says they've sued these pipeline projects to ensure state and federal agencies are following the law when they issue permits, so those in Appalachia aren't left holding the bag.
The risk here is that communities are left with the cleanup and with the pollution, but without the economic benefit.
Pipeline construction is boosting state tax revenues from the natural gas industry, says Sean O'Leary, a senior policy analyst at the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy.
But we know these projects are going to start winding down in the next year, and when they do, that revenue is going to vanish.
He says broadly, economists have not seen sweeping economic benefits from the natural gas industry at large, despite its sixfold growth during the past decade.
And what we've seen is that the impact that has been there has been very, very narrow, that the growth is really concentrated in the industry itself.
O'Leary says the same is likely true of these pipeline projects.
Once the pipeline is constructed, once the construction is over, it's a pipe, and there's not a whole lot left behind.
According to pipeline developer Dominion, the ACP will require just a few dozen permanent full-time employees once construction is over. Still, the company is confident some workers will be back on the job by the end of the year. In Valley Head, Melissa Wilfong says she can't wait.
They've just done several things for people in the community, and I think, you know, once they come back, they'll continue to do that.
Recently, Dominion asked the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case regarding its U.S. Forest Service permit to cross the Appalachian Trail. It's one of seven permits the project needs before it can fully resume construction. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Recently, the BREATHE Project and the Carnegie Museum of Art put on an art and air quality awareness event they called BREATHE Better Day, in coordination with the museum's ongoing exhibit, Monet and the Modern City. Speakers from various environmental organizations gave presentations on the sources and effects of air pollution in the Pittsburgh region. The exhibit includes works from Impressionists like Camille Pissarro and Claude Monet, and American paintings of Pittsburgh's own industrial aesthetic by the likes of Aaron Gorson and Joseph Stella. The Allegheny Front's summer intern, Jack Austin, spoke with some of the people at the event, including curator Akemi May.
I wanted to really tie it into sort of Pittsburgh and to the region and to really pull from our permanent collection. So the industrial imagery really spoke to me. That's why we organized this exhibition, which is in large part about the sort of depictions at the turn of the century of a modern industrial landscape. I think that people really respond to art in a very personal way, and they bring to it their own past and their own experiences.
My name's Lois Bauer Bjornson, and I live in Scenery Hill, Pennsylvania. We're about 40 minutes south of Pittsburgh, and I grew up along the Monongahela River. I remember the stories that my dad told me about at my grandparents' hotel when they couldn't hang the sheets out because of the time when the coal mines were, you know, there was soot everywhere, and it was nothing to have 2 inches of coal dust on the window sills.
I've heard from a lot of people who have come to this exhibition, you know, that they struggle with looking at these and seeing the aesthetic beauty of industry, which at the time that these artists were creating these images, they did look at smoke and fog as being very sort of romantic and indicative of power and prosperity. But we, as modern audience, look at it with a totally different lens. You know, we think about it in terms of air quality and pollution.
Michael DeMonte. So I came because I'm interested in our environment. I live in Cranberry, so I'm downwind of where this cracker plant, where the Shell cracker is going to go. I am impressed by the relevance of art in, you know, social issues, how important it is for us, and how artists can touch emotion in society that might bring about more action than the scientific facts and figures. The paintings by Monet of the bridge strike me in how blurred that image is. It's surprising that such a famous work, looking at it today, is so mottled. And that's the way it looked, because the pollution was so very, very bad. And at that time, the artist did not recognize that to be a bad thing. He didn't recognize it to be poisonous. He saw it as beautiful. Today, maybe we have some of the same choices. We're looking at something that we think is advancement, and it's beautiful, but there may be hidden problems.
My name is Suzanne Seppi, and I'm with Group Against Smog and Pollution. Air pollution in general in Pittsburgh, we've been ranked very poorly. So we're here to talk to people and try to get them involved in calling their representatives and talking about bad odors or asthma problems and saying, you know, really, you have to do something about this. There's no reason why Pittsburgh shouldn't be a cleaner city. And I guess I want people to feel that urgency.
If you'd like to see the exhibit for yourself, Monet and the Modern City runs until September 2nd at the Carnegie Museum of Art in Pittsburgh. The Allegheny Front's Jack Austin produced that story. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schuman Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth.